Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Been There, Done That. I'm your host, Ben. First, I want to start with some information about the show. From the beginning, the show was supposed to be a mixture of ideas. Supposed to be serious topics, sports, and dating. And I failed to keep that promise. So, starting this week, I'm going to start doing 3 shows a week, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Mondays will be our serious topics, you know, informative and kind of figuring out hot button topics. Wednesdays will be sports with my sports co-host, Vegas Moody. And Friday will be dating advice, Tinder horror stories, and questions that you all send in to me about really dating in general in the year 2019 with all the social media we have nowadays. But for tonight's topic, I want to share something personal with you because I kind of touched on it in the first episode. And I didn't go into much further detail because it's something that's hard to talk about. And it's something that I haven't really shared with anyone, at least the full story of what really happened with my time in the Army. It's not because I'm ashamed or sad about what happened. It's just because there's a lot of moving parts in order to see the full picture. But if I'm going to do this show, I want to be completely translucent with you. I want to have no secrets, because if you can't trust me, why are you listening to me in the first place? Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you everything from the beginning, because it's kind of boring up until about halfway through, if I'm being completely honest with you. But I like to think of this kind of like a therapy session. I've been out of the Army for over 6 years now, and sitting down and writing my story, some of it just seems like some bullshit on a TV show, if I'm being completely honest. I know a lot of people say that, but to really fully grasp everything that happened to me, it's still mind-boggling that it actually occurred. And I want to share it with you, because some of you that are listening to this have gone through some of this in your lives, just in different circumstances. So I'm going to start in the year 2010. I had just turned 20. I had just got to my first duty station in Fort Wainwright, Alaska. We have to fast forward a little bit in order to understand what I mean. The year is 2010. The month is December. I have to lay a little background information on this first part, because I'm going to throw some terms out to you that you may not understand, and I'm going to have to explain each of them to you so you can better get a grip of what happened. So, the year is 2010, the month is December, about a week before Christmas. And in the Army, around that time, during the holiday season, specifically 3 times of the year: summertime, Thanksgiving, and Christmas. There is something that the military has, at least to my knowledge the Army has, called block leave. And what that means is, during those three blocks of time, you are allowed to take leave without question. And how leave works in the Army is paid vacation. For every 30 days that you are in the military, you receive 1.5 days of leave, right? So I had been in the Army since, really, June of 2010, and we were at December of 2010. But being in Alaska, it's very expensive to travel. It's about $1,500 round trip to really go anywhere from Alaska. And I didn't have $1,500. At the time, my pay every 2 weeks was $525. That is what I made every 2 weeks in the Army. Now, it's Christmas time of 2010, as I said. A lot of people are starting to leave early for block leave. I'm not one of them. Instead, I'm at the barracks. Barracks are like your apartment that the Army provides to you free. I mean, technically, tax dollars pay for it, but it is provided to you. It's a living space, just a room with a bed and some cheap-ass furniture that I feel like they found on the street, essentially. You have the most basic essentials. You've got a kitchen that's like the shittiest kitchen you could possibly imagine. You've got only one burner on the stove works. The microwave looks like someone took a baseball bat to it. And the bathroom, even though I did my best to maintain it at optimum conditions, still look like a pile of shit. Because I'm pretty sure that toilet hadn't been changed since 1985. But, so now you have a picture of what my living conditions were. It's block leave. People are leaving early. My parents couldn't afford, really, because it was about $2,000 or $2,500, roughly, because it's Christmas time, to round trip ticket me home. And I wouldn't ask them to, because I wouldn't want someone to pay $2,500 just to see me for 3 days. So I was stuck in Alaska with maybe 8 of the 100 people in my company, in my barracks. Now, there's 2 people assigned per barrack room, right? You walk into your barracks, you've got the little living room area, which is a table, and it's connected to the kitchen, and there's one bathroom that you share, and then there's 2 rooms divides. I'm there with my roommate, who's also not going on leave because he's from Guatemala. And at the time, one of the individuals that was left with us was my team leader. And what that means in military terms is that he was in charge of myself and my roommate. I was a private, my roommate was a private, and this individual, who I'm not going to name, was a specialist. He was prior service. He had served in the Marines. He was in the initial invasion to Iraq. For lack of better terms, he had seen some shit, so he wasn't all there, which is sad but true. And one night, around the 20th, which was a weekend if I'm not mistaken, it was a Friday or a Saturday, I don't recall which, he had gotten extremely drunk. And for some reason, and to this day, I'll never understand why, I just accepted that it was what it was. This individual did not like me in particular. Was I the greatest soldier on the planet? Absolutely not. I was a 20-year-old kid. Okay? I'd come from a family that had given me anything that I needed, really, as a kid. Up until that point in my life, I was never really hurting for a meal. I was never wondering where my next meal was going to come from. You know, I had a car given to me. It wasn't the greatest on the planet, but I had a car given to me. You know, I never had to wonder about clothing or where I was going to sleep at. I mean, I was really babied. So, for me, the whole military thing was a culture shock, almost. Because I had never really done anything on my own. And so I became codependent on my roommate and my battle buddies, meaning the people that were in my platoon and my squad, to kind of help me, you know, become a man. Because up to that point, I was a kid. I was a child. I mean, I still was a child, but I was learning slowly how to become a man. You know, how to make financial decisions, how to make emotional decisions, how to make just the most basic everyday things become systematic. Things that I had never done before. Things like pay a cell phone bill. I had never really done that. And so, as I was saying, I was really close to my roommate. But the person I despised the most was my squad leader, because he had a real temper and he did not like me in particular. Again, I don't know what I did to trigger this person to hate me almost, but they did. And that hatred came in the form of physical punishment almost every day. And when I say physical punishment, in the Army they call that smoking someone, meaning that you make them do really shitty workouts until the point of exhaustion. Now you're probably thinking, what do you mean, like push-ups, sit-ups? Yeah, in the simplest form. But not for this man. I mean things like making me run across the street to the barracks from our company headquarters, run up 8 flights of stairs to my room, put on my full gas mask and my chem suit, my chemical warfare suit, and my boots and my body armor, and run all the way back down and make it back in formation to him in 5 minutes or less. And I did that every day. Literally every day for about 3 months. Monday through Friday. Obviously in Army you have weekends off unless you're punished. Or you're on punishment, meaning you have things called extra duty. Which, if you get in trouble, that's what you have to do. So Monday through Friday, that's what I did. For hours at a time. I mean, literally hours at a time. And if it wasn't that, it was kicking the shit out of me in a coat closet that no one else could see. Or it was pushing me downstairs while I'm walking to my room in the barracks because he knows I can't touch him. Because he's above me in the chain of command. And who's going to believe me when I tell my uppers, hey, the person that you're depending on to lead me into battle is kicking the shit out of me and taking it to a level that's probably not allowed. Can you please help me? Ah, oh, fuck off. You're a private. What do you know? That was a dilemma that I had. And back to this situation. One night, as I stated, he had gotten really drunk. And as I previously told you, this individual wasn't all there in the head. He had seen a lot of terrible fucking things in Iraq that changed who he was as a person. And he had a lot of built-up anger. And one night, he came barging to my room. Practically kicked the door down until my roommate answered it, because I could hear him on the other side of the door drunkenly saying my name and my roommate's, telling us to open the door, for lack of better terms. So my roommate reluctantly opened the door because he just wanted it to stop, because he felt if he didn't open it, that it was going to continue all night. Because this is the kind of person that would keep doing it all night long. I remember him opening the door and barging his way in and taking my roommate and throwing him across the floor and then looking at me and asking me if I wanted to die. I remember thinking to myself, what am I supposed to do? I'm twice the size of this person, but if I lay hands on this man, if I defend myself, no one's going to believe what's about to happen. Because something told me at that very moment that something terrible is about to take place. I just didn't know what it was. He then proceeded to grab my roommate by the collar of his shirt while he was on the ground, drag him into my room, throw me in as well with one hand, kick my door open, put my roommate on the floor next to me while I was sitting on my bed, and then proceeded to pull a 9mm pistol out of his pants. Now this next part is really hard to talk about because this is something that I had to testify in later on down the road. And I've only talked about this one other time in my life. And that was at a courtroom of my peers in Afghanistan. But we'll get to that in a little while. Now I want to paint this picture for you because I feel like I'm not doing a great enough job of putting everything into perspective. This man has myself and my roommate sitting on my bed on the floor next to one another with a gun pointed at us while he's drunk, and then proceeds to tell my roommate to take his clothes off. I did not know if the gun was real, nor did my roommate, and I was kind of just frozen because I didn't know what to do. Nothing in my life had ever prepared me for a moment like this. I had never experienced anything like it, and I just sat there in shock because the person that I'm supposed to trust with my life has a gun pointed at me, telling me to do things, and I'm just taken back by it. And as my roommate took his clothes off, so did he. He began taking his clothes off as well. And he told my roommate to lay on my bed and then proceeded to sexually assault him while pointing a gun at my head and telling me to watch. This went on for about 10 minutes until he decided it was enough and then turned around, walked out the room into our kitchen and told us never to say a word of it and walked out. That was my first experience of having someone point a gun in my face and the first time I'd ever felt helpless in my life. And that was within the first 6 months of being in the army, in the infantry, where you are told your job is to kill or be killed. I cannot put into words how demasculating that was in that moment of time for myself or my roommate. And to this day, I can still remember what it felt like
for those 10 minutes that were only 10 minutes but felt like a lifetime. And how I had to still trust that person with my life when I left for Afghanistan in just a few months. How I could be in a situation where I'm getting shot at and I have to hope and pray that that person doesn't allow me to die. So we fast forward from December until May. Now in that time, you're probably thinking to yourself, why didn't you tell anyone? Well, the problem is that I did. At first, I called my brother, who was still serving in the Army at the time, who was working in D.C., who was higher up in the military, and he told me to report it to my chaplain. A chaplain in the Army is like a priest, right? So I did. I told him, and I'll never forget what he told me as I'm sitting there in tears telling this person about what happened to me, because my roommate is too traumatized to tell anyone himself because he's embarrassed. And he looked at me and he said, "Suck it up, Buttercup." That's when I knew that no matter what happened, it was me versus the enemy versus the Army. I had never felt more alone in my life. Now, everything that I had told you about getting the shit kicked out of me continued every single fucking day. Every day. Until May of 2011, when we got our orders to go to a place called Panjiway, Afghanistan. Now, if you're wondering where the fuck that's at in Afghanistan, it's in the southwest corner, near the Pakistan border. We were going to an area called Panjiway, and we were going to be replacing Canadian Special Forces team out there. So we get there. And how it works when you arrive to your combat zone, your company is assigned an AO, meaning an area of operations, right? Your AO usually consists of four different locations because you have four different platoons. In our case, it was three. And a lot of other companies that were in our unit were also three, but most of the time it's four. And the reason that you're assigned three is because you have four platoons, and one platoon, which is called headquarters, which is where your soldiers who aren't going into frontline combat, either because they're injured or, in Army terms, they're shitbags. They're not the ideal frontline soldier. So they do the paperwork, they're your armor, I mean, they're the ones that assign you weapons, or they work hand in hand with the first sergeant and the CO, meaning the commanding officer, your captain, and they kind of are their laborers. One of those platoons, meaning headquarters, would stay with the main FOB, right? Your company command area. While the other three platoons would be split up to COPS. And COPS are these small little bases that are meant to hold maybe 15 people, and you have about 35 people crammed into that space. You got sometimes people sharing bunks, you got people sleeping on rocks, you got these shitty ass tents that you're given to sleep under. I mean, the most shitty conditions you can possibly imagine in a fucking third world country. That is what it was like. At the time, I was put into 3rd Platoon. And the reason that this is significant is because at the time, we were kind of seen as rule breakers. We had all the shitbags that weren't bad enough to go to the headquarters platoon, but they didn't take orders very well. So we were kind of considered to be rogue, if you will. So they gave us the shittiest of operations areas. They stuck us in a place where we would end up losing 4 people in a matter of 2 months to KIA or to loss of limb, meaning they lost a leg or amputee or whatever else. So we're on our COP, and we had lost some people, like I said. So the Army has to replace those people because we can't have platoons in combat that are less than ideal fighting numbers, right? You've got to have the maximum amount of soldiers you can have to maintain your area so that bad guys don't go and plant more IEDs and go and recruit people in town to become Taliban and sell all the crops they have for more drug, or all the drug money that they get from taking their opium crops and turning it into more money to buy more weapons, because that's what happens. I feel like I have to explain this part because a lot of people don't know. Afghanistan has a massive, and I mean absolutely massive, circulation of opium. A lot of weed, a lot of hashish, as they call it, which is just super strong weed. Okay? And they use those crops that they grow all year long, and they cut them down, all right, and they sell it on the open market, and they make millions of dollars. Now, the best way I can describe this, there are fields of weed and opium, and this is not a joke. This, you can Google it for yourself. The images are breathtaking. The average plant, okay, in these massive crops is about 10 to 12 feet tall. 10 to 12 feet tall. And a lot of times our job is to go in, cut it all down with machines and machetes and whatever else we can gather, put our gas mask on, throw it in a pile, and burn it to hell. So they can't use that crop to go buy more weapons to kill us with. And in turn, this pisses off a lot of the town folk because that's their crop. That's how they make a living. So what happens then? They get pissed off, and then they join the Taliban. That is Afghanistan in a nutshell. See, when we got there, the idea was, and this was repeated over and over again, to win the hearts and minds of the people. In other words, to convince them that the Taliban was bad and we were good. And us installing our form of government in their country was in their best interest. Which sounds like a good idea. Until you realize that their only source of income is illegal. And it's our job to take it away. And then try, after destroying their only source of income, to tell them and convince them that we're not the enemy. Which is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard in my life. That would be like me going to your home and burning it down and being like, hey, I'm still your friend, right? 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 That is what it's like. And in the meat of all this, we're killing the Taliban, who 90% of the time are their relatives. It's their brothers, it's their fathers, their cousins, their uncles, their mothers, their daughters, because they don't have a choice. See, a lot of them are kidnapped at a young age by the Taliban as payment so that the Taliban will leave the other parts of the family alone. And we kill them because that's our job. Take that with a grain of salt if you will, but that's the war on terror, essentially. So, we had lost a few soldiers, right? So the army's got to replace them. How do they replace them? They send us fresh recruits who just graduated basic training. Kids. A lot of which are 18, 19, 20 years old, like myself, who barely just graduated high school, who can't even legally buy liquor. To send them from basic to go fight in Afghanistan. And more than likely, the odds are already stacked against you to die in combat. And one of the such soldiers that we had gotten was a private by the name of Danny Chin, who was an 18-year-old kid from New York. And the reason I'm telling you that name is because it has a lot of semblance. See, Danny was a replacement troop, okay? But he was different. He was an 18-year-old, 110-pound, soaking wet kid who was no taller than 5'4" at most. And I don't know why. To this day, I still never know why. And even in the trial, they never really gave an honest answer. But they made this kid a target. See, as I told you before, for the longest time while I was at that unit, I was a subject of a lot of physical abuse. There were others as well. But for some reason, they had stopped, for the most part, of physical abuse when we deployed. But when Danny arrived, it picked up again. But this time it wasn't towards myself or the others. It was towards him. And I had thought that what I was going through before we deployed was hell on earth, until I saw what they did to this kid. And I mean, they kicked the shit out of him on a daily basis. So how it works is, you go on missions, right? Half of the platoon from your COP, the area that I was explaining earlier, half of your platoon goes on patrol and the other half stays behind to watch the base. Well, every time Danny would go on mission, when it wasn't his turn to stay back and guard the base, we'd go on patrol, and you're on patrol, you're on mission, and you're walking around the town, people, and you're talking to them, and you end up probably getting shot at, and you end up probably finding a bomb with the mine detector that you're carrying on your arm, which weighs about 15 fucking pounds, and you gotta stop and dig it out, and then you gotta call the bomb squad out there to blow it in place, or BIP, if you will. And this usually takes about 12 hours a day, 12 to 14 hours, sometimes even 48 hours. I was on mission for 48 hours 3 times while I was there. It just happens. It's just the luck of the draw sometimes. And we come off mission, and we get back, and you're exhausted, okay? It is 125, 140 degrees with 100% humidity in this shithole country, where people are trying to kill you every single day. And we would come back, and as soon as mission was over, and after you had washed yourself, because there is no shower in Afghanistan, okay? You shower by taking bottles of water and running them on your body. with care packages of shampoo and body wash that are sent to us by our loved ones. As a shower in Afghanistan. And after we would shower and Danny would get changed, we'd all get changed, they'd drag him from his bunk and they'd take turns fucking with him. I mean, kicking him, spitting on him, punching him, calling him chink, whatever else you could think of as a derogatory term for an Asian, they probably called it to him. And this went on for about, he got there in August of 2011. This went on until September of 2011, so about a month, month and a half, roughly. Until one day, we had come off mission, and we were out there for 24 hours, and we'd come back, and it was probably 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. We were all sleeping. We were exhausted, okay? We were all sleeping. And they dragged Danny from his top bunk across the rocks on the ground, zip-tied him to a porta-potty we had there, and then proceeded to kick the shit out of him. And then after they were done, the person that had pointed a gun at me all those months ago, after kicking the shit out of him, decided to piss all over Danny. We all had to sit there and watch. You're probably thinking, why didn't you intervene? Why didn't you stop it? Well, that's easier said than done whenever people are pointing guns at you again. And the people that are doing this are your uppers. People that are in charge of you. People that you feel morally obligated to listen to because they're the ones that are making plans for you not to die in combat the next day. And they all took turns beating the shit out of him. And then this man who I'll not name pissed on him and told us not to touch him. And then proceeded to go back to their rooms. They were on the other side of the cop and go to sleep. Bunch of us cleaned him up from the piss and blood that was covering him. About 6 hours later, after we already cleaned him, they came and unzip-tied him and told him he had to pull guard duty. It was supposed to be his and those of us who went on missions day off. Danny being the trooper that he was, because what else are you going to do? You got to do what they say. Can't go complain to anyone because no one was going to believe you because you're just a private. Takes his battle rattle, meaning his body armor, his helmet, his rifle, his uniform. Puts it all on. Walks outside the tent area. Goes to the guard tower. Climbs a ladder to the guard tower. Turns around and faces everyone. And then proceeds to put the rifle underneath his chin and blow his brains out. It was at that moment that it hit all of us. That that could have been any of us. And after that, CID, meaning we'll call it the secret police, the investigators, like the FBI of the Army, came in and they did an investigation. And they took those that were responsible for it and put them in prison. Well, excuse me, they arrested them, put them on trial, in which all of us who were there for it had to go testify against them about what happened, as they were charged with negligence and second-degree murder. There were 8 of them, if I'm not mistaken. You can Google this if you want the names. I'm not going to say them because legally I cannot. But that was the second event that happened in my time. The third event that changed me as a person in my time in the Army, we gotta fast forward again to about 6 months later, February of 2012. I was on a mission, and I was in a striker, which means, I was in like a tank almost, right? A tank with a ramp in the back, essentially what a striker is. And I happened to be in the vehicle that hit an IED, meaning an improvised explosive device. They plant these in the road and they blow them up when a vehicle goes over them or a person steps on one. Just happened to be my turn that day. So I get blown up. I'm unconscious. I'm essentially in a coma. Alright? I'm in a traumatic brain injury induced coma for a little bit. I come to and it's a few weeks later, and I have to relearn a lot of things that most of us take for granted. For about 7 months after that, I have terrible memory loss. I have to essentially relearn the English language, basic mathematics. I cannot be around light very long, or else it triggers migraines in my head that are so painful that it makes you want to cry. And I can't remember anything longer than 10 minutes. Things like, am I wearing pants? What's my name? What year is it? Where the fuck am I? Things that you don't even think about on a daily basis. That was my life for about 7 months. To the point where I actually contemplated suicide because I was so sick and tired of remembering something and being scared to forget it. I would literally take sticky notes and stick them all over my body with little things like, your name is Ben, it's going to be okay. Things like that. And after it happened, they determined that I wasn't able to do my job anymore, and they couldn't treat me in Afghanistan, so I had to send me back, because I'm still considered property of my unit. I'm still assigned to my unit, so they sent me back to Alaska, except this time, instead of being in the middle of nowhere, Fairbanks, Alaska, which is where Fort Wainwright is, which was my first duty station, they sent me to the big city of Alaska, known as Anchorage, where they have one of the best traumatic brain injury facilities in the whole military, besides Walter Reed, which is in Washington, D.C., and Hawaii. They determined that the best course of action for me was to go be close to my unit, which was still deployed, but my unit was based out of Alaska, so they said, you're going to go back to Alaska. So I went there. Now keep in mind, okay, they sent me back about a month and a half, 2 months after I've been injured, okay? I'm still struggling with my memory, all right? I'm still struggling with being around light, okay? I'm still relearning things at a basic level, and they stick me back in Alaska. I have no access to my money. I have no phone. I have no friends there. The only friends that I have are in Afghanistan. I have no contact with them. And it's like this for about 2 weeks, okay? I would literally wake up and stay in my barracks room and be awake for 18 to 20 hours every day because I was just depressed as shit. Finally, I was able to gain access to my money, got a cell phone, still was not allowed to communicate with my unit. To this day, I still don't know why, but I just wasn't. All my friends, I couldn't talk to them. My family couldn't go see them. I was in something called a WTU, which stands for a Warrior Transition Unit, right? Like a Wounded Warrior Project unit, okay? All the people that were in there had been injured or could no longer perform their job duties that were given to them by the Army. So they were in this unit, either going to be processed out, meaning medically retired, or they were there until they got well enough to go back into their unit to go perform their duties that were assigned to them by the Army. Well, me being freshly 21, not being able to see my family, still in a depressed mood, I became an alcoholic. Now, when I say alcoholic, I don't mean like, oh, I'll go to the bar and have a drink. No, I mean every day. Literally every day of the week, I would wake up. If I remembered where the fuck I was at, I would call a cab to take me to the Class 9, meaning the liquor store on base, and I would buy whatever bottle I saw that looked the coolest, and I would get back in a cab, and I would go back to my room, and I would proceed to drink that whole bottle. And I did that every day for about 7 months. And after a while, I got bored of it. And to spice things up, I started doing drugs. Because why the fuck not? I'm in Alaska. I'm thousands of miles away from anyone that I care about. I don't have any friends. I don't talk to anyone in the unit because, well, they have their own issues. I've got no one watching me. I've got no leadership. I'm just on my own. I'm just a kid still. So why the fuck not? So at first I start with weed. You know, I found a local dealer off base that I would take a cab to. And I'd buy, you know, probably about $50 to $100 of weed a week, and I'd smoke weed every day, and I did that for a few months. I switched to psychedelics. I tried mushrooms. I did that for about 3 or 4 months. Tried coke. I mean, I reached a point in my life where I just didn't care. I honestly just wanted to die, if I'm being completely honest with you. Because I felt like my life that I had been stripped away from me. And I reached a point where I had had enough. And I asked for help. And the Army decided it was in the best interest of myself and the Army to go ahead and medically retire me out. So instead of sending me to rehab, instead of continuously helping with my recovery, they wanted to wash their hands free. Now keep in mind, while this is all going on, okay, while I'm still relearning the basics of life, while I'm going through my phase of alcoholism and drug addiction, I am flying from Alaska to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to testify in the murder case that I mentioned earlier. Once a month. It was on the news everywhere. The individuals who were charged barely got a slap on the wrist. literally a slap on the wrist. So after doing this for about a year, starting in March of 2012 until March of 2013, I was finally given my papers and I was medically retired out of the Army. So I'm 22 years old. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. I'm barely functioning in the world, physically and mentally. And the Army has decided it's in the best interest for us to go our separate ways. To this day, I'll never understand their decision. But at the same time, if someone were to ask me, would you do it all over again? After everything that happened to me, after the countless times of getting the shit kicked out of me, to watching my buddies die, to burying my friends, to watching people kill themselves, to doing horrific things in that godforsaken country, to being kicked out, to being an alcoholic and a drug addict. The answer would be yeah. Because I don't know what the hell my life would have been. I don't know how I would have ever grown up, how I've ever matured, if it wasn't for those things. Do they make me mad? Yes. Every single day of my life, in some form or fashion, I am reminded of that hell. But that has made me the man I am today. I have 2 college degrees. I have a nice paying job. And none of that would be possible if it wasn't for those horrific things that I had to go through in that little 3-year period of my life known as the Army. But I just wanted to share that with you tonight. Because I wanted you to know the truth about who it is you're listening to. And for those that know me, that are hearing this story for the first time, I want you to know that I've been struggling to tell this story for about 6 years. It's taken me 6 years to come out and tell you. And in that time, there have been so many occasions that I've wanted to, but I just couldn't. Because I just didn't think that the time was right. But it feels good to finally get off my chest. And now you all know who you're listening to, as I said. On a lighter note, as I said earlier at the beginning of this episode, I'll be doing 3 shows a week now with the help of my old Army buddy, who I still keep in contact with. He'll be helping me every Wednesday doing our sports podcast, our sports episode on this podcast, excuse me. And every Friday, we'll be doing our dating segment. I hope you all enjoyed tonight's episode. I know it was a lot to take in, but I hope to be joined by you all again. My name is Ben, and this has been episode number 3 of Been There, Done That. Thank you, and have a good night.